Hi, this is Eric Schlein of the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today's episode of the Intelligent Investing Podcast is sponsored by Red Rock Running. Runners and joggers out there, tell me if this sounds familiar. You go into your local running store to pick up some gear, first the shirt, and as you browse the shirts, you see that nice, high-quality performance shirt running you at least $40. Then, you need something to carry your smartphone so you can listen to the Intelligent Investing Podcast while you run. Or maybe you want to track your run with a GPS. A smartphone carrier costs something like $20 or $30. And between work, family, and other responsibilities, the only chance many of us have to go for a run is early in the morning or late at night. That often means running in the dark. So, to help stay safe, you need a reflective vest to increase visibility. That's another $10, $15. So, in total, you can expect to spend over $100 just for gear that goes on your upper body. Red Rock Running has a better way. Their new Bryce running shirt combines all three of those products into one simple item. Secure pockets built directly into each sleeve carry your smartphone or other audio device, a couple of keys, headphones, or energy gels. Strategically placed, reflective material increases your visibility, keeping you safe when running in the dark. Intelligent Investing Podcast listeners know the importance of value. Purchasing a technical shirt, smartphone carrier, and a reflective vest separately costs over $100. The Bryce running shirt, however, gives you all three for only $59. And Red Rock Running is offering listeners this podcast an additional 15% off any purchase by using the promo code INVESTINGPOD at checkout. So that's right, listeners, if you are a listener of the Intelligent Investing Podcast, you get an additional 15% off any purchase of a shirt that's already a good value by using that promo code INVESTINGPOD at checkout. So remember, go to Red Rock Running, REDROCK, running.com, and receive 15% off your Bryce running shirt with promo code INVESTINGPOD, INVESTINGPOD. Carry more, increase visibility, decrease hassle.
Welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, where modern portfolio theory can suck it. A student of the school of Graham and Doddsville and a clergy member of the Church of Warren Buffett. Here's your host, Eric Schlein.
Hi, this is Eric Schlein. You're listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today we have a very interesting guy on the show. As per his request, I am going to keep him anonymous, and I'm going to use the pseudonym that he writes under, which is DTEJD1997. He's someone who's been managing family money for over 20 years, has a pretty good track record, and brilliant investor, but he tends to... He likes to stay low-key and under the radar, so I wanted to respect that on the show, but I'm very honored to have this man on the show. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Eric. I appreciate the time being spent here interviewing me. I've listened to, you've got a great podcast, and I'm honored to be on here. Thank you.
Well, thanks for coming on. I'm honored for you to be on. So let's just jump right into it. You do some very interesting stuff, and you invest in some very obscure stuff in what you call frontier investing. Do you want to explain to the listeners what it means to be a frontier investor?
Sure, Eric. Well, frontier investing is going to where the bargains and the good opportunities are at. And frequently I'll find those in, say, African countries, Asian countries. Of course, there are a tremendous amount of stocks out there. Most of them are not in the U.S., but there's just a tremendous amount of opportunities outside American borders. So if you want the bargains, you kind of have to go to where they're at. And frequently that can be Africa, Asia, Europe. And it's easier for American investors to buy those stocks than what most people will think. Frequently there are gray market ADRs.
And now explain to people what that means.
Well, an ADR is an American depository receipt, and those will be foreign companies trading on American exchanges. typically over the counter, typically pink sheet. So you do have to use, you know, do quite a bit of due diligence. And obviously, just like in the U.S., you know, you may have to look at 50 or 75 or 100 different situations to find something that is investable and is offers good returns. But they are certainly out there. So if you are willing to do the work, you can find them. And these will trade over the counter, and they will typically have an F in the stock ticker. For example, one of the stocks that I own and have done well with is Caledonia Mining. And that is a gold miner in Zimbabwe.
So, you know, when people hear gold miner in Zimbabwe, people are going to, you know, freak out, right? So,
oh, absolutely. Right? And well that they should, you know, because Zimbabwe is not something that I would say, you know, hey, I've got some money burning a hole in my pocket. Zimbabwe is the place I need to go. But with that being said, the first time I invested in Caledonia Mining, the stock was trading for in the high, just below 60 cents a share. Okay.
And if what, what were you getting for 60 cents a share?
Well, that's what makes it investable. A, the company is debt free. B, the market at that point in time, the company had approximately 60% of the market cap in cash. And the vast majority of that cash was kept either in London, England, or Johannesburg, South Africa. So a lot of their assets were out of Zimbabwe and could not be confiscated by the government.
And what currency was the cash in?
Pound sterling and U.S. dollars and South African rand. But it gets a lot better from there, because the gold mine that they owned at that point in time had been in operation for over 90 years. And now their mine has been in operation for over 100 years. And the interesting thing is they have never they've never run out of gold. They keep finding more. So they've got a good reserve, and at the point that I initially bought in, the dividend yield was close to 10%. It wasn't 10%, but it was like 9.25, just over that. And it was also trading for a single-digit PE. So, I mean, where in the United States are you going to find a debt-free company with a single-digit PE paying close to a 10% dividend yield?
Well, the argument you could have made is that may not have been normalized earnings, right, where you'll see a commodity company trading three times earnings and then earnings fall off a cliff.
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely, for sure. And at that, their earnings have grown substantially since then, which may make it investable today, even after its big run-up in price. Because they are slowly expanding their mine. And the interesting thing with a lot of miners is they will have fixed costs, you know, corporate overhead, physical plant, and so on and so forth. So the more rock and ore that they can process, the earnings will go up. You know, let's say they double their revenue. Their earnings could go up four times. So they've got tremendous leverage once their fixed costs have been met. And that is the case with Caledonia Mining. Now, of course, with that being said, it does carry tremendous risk. You know, and there's a lot more to the story than what, you know, we can get into here. And of course, you know, people should not take my word for it. You've got to do your own due diligence, you know, and that's another good thing is that management is very open and very receptive to shareholders, and they are very committed to paying the dividend and have paid, I think, about close to 4 years now of dividends. So, you know, does it carry a tremendous amount of risk? Well, yes, it does. But I think at the right price, potential investors and investors are being adequately compensated for the risk that they are taking. And that is one stock that has worked well for me and I think will work well into the future.
How long ago did you invest in this?
Pardon me?
How long ago did you make that investment?
Oh, about 3 years ago.
Okay.
And I've traded in and out of it a couple times, you know, taking profits and putting it back in. Now, with that being said, obviously, you know, I make mistakes, and sometimes even with the best research and the best positioning, you still take losses.
And we'll get into some of your mistakes in a little bit. How did you get into all of this? Because, you know, what you do is very obscure. What started you down this road?
Well, it's quite a long story, but I'd always been interested in business and investing even since my childhood. And when I turned 18 and went away to college, I'm like, okay, you know, I've always been interested in this, so now I'm going to get started. You know, and my family had a broker that they used, and so I called them up and opened an account. And, you know, I knew that I wanted to invest, but, you know, knowing what you want to do and how to do it are two different things. So at first, you know, I just started taking his advice, you know, on what to trade and what to buy. And sometimes it worked out and sometimes it didn't. And to be perfectly honest with you, it probably did not work quite, you know, the way I wanted it to. And my returns were mediocre at best. But what I started doing is I would go to the library to study at night for my, you know, for my classes. And the library had Value Line and Barron's and Forbes and the Wall Street Journal. So I would get all of those and start reading. And after, you know, I don't know, maybe a year or so, I started reading about, you know, value investing and value investors. And it kind of started clicking into place that, you know, just like in life, you know, if you want to get good returns, you have to look for the good bargains. And the other thing that I started to realize or that clicked in my head is that in order to get returns that were better or different than the market, you have to be willing to do or to take positions that others will not take. And for me, that meant buying things that are out of favor, stocks that may have problems with them, obscure stocks outside of the U.S., just kind of taking a contrarian position. And what really kind of opened my eyes was there was an article in Barron's, and I can't remember the exact date, but they profiled a book called Walker's Manual for unlisted and obscure securities. And I got my hands on a copy of that book, and I'm like, wow, I've got a couple of stocks in here. And at that point in time, there were just some incredible bargains out there. You know, American stocks trading for PEs of, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, paying dividends, solid balance sheets, so on and so forth.
And what year was this?
This would have been
at least around
in the mid-90s.
Okay.
Like 1995, maybe 1996, something like that. And the guy, well, it's a lot, the author of the book, you know, was talking about stocks that he had bought for a PE of 1 or less than 1, you know, and the tremendous returns that you could get if you could find these, you know, unlisted and very thinly traded stocks.
Now, have you ever bought a stock at a PE less than 1?
I don't know about less than 1, but very close, yes.
What would you mind sharing what it was?
Sure. Well, there have actually been a couple. One of them is Federal Screwworks.
Okay.
And contrary to the name, they do not make screws.
Now, do you currently own shares of this company? Or?
Yes, I do. And it is a very obscure microcap company here in the Detroit area. They've been in business since, it's either 1916 or 1917. So they're about 100 years old. But, you know, once again, you know, do your own due diligence and don't rely on me for your investment decisions. But
nor me.
Yes. So do your own due diligence. But the interesting thing about Federal Screw, well, there are many interesting things, but I had followed this stock back since the mid-90s. And that's one of the stocks that is profiled in the Walker's Manual. And also, the Detroit papers have, you know, all the local companies. You know, and there could be, you know, I don't know, maybe 200 different local publicly traded companies. And Federal Screw was one of them. So I kind of watched them and, you know, kind of keep up with them a little bit because they were a local company. But I never invested in it for a long period of time just because I was doing other things. And the stock, I just couldn't get into it or get a good a good trade on it. So anyway, as most auto companies had problems in back in 2008, 2009, they certainly did too. And they had a very long history of making, you know, good returns, paying dividends, making good money, and that all came to an end in the great meltdown there of 08. But the company did not enter bankruptcy. And management did keep it going, but they lost quite a bit of money. And the stock got all the way down to, I think it was about $1.50 a share. And at that point, I was thinking, oh, you know, they're either done for or they're so impaired, you know, they'll never come back. And I just kind of wrote them off. And one of the investing blogs that I read, Oddball Stocks, had done a short profile on it, and they said, hey, you know, they're kind of sort of turning things around, and they're kind of making money. So I looked at it, and the quote on both Google and Yahoo showed that they were losing money, quite a bit of money, actually. So I'm like, wait a minute, this doesn't look right. But if you went to the company's website and you look at the FC, the filings, they actually were making money.
And what? Wait, Yahoo Finance had wrong numbers? Amazing.
I know, it's shocking, hard to believe. But that was the case. And the interesting thing was, is they actually had turned it around. And, excuse me, you know, at that point, I thought that they made screws. You know, but I contacted the company, and they're like, well, you know, no, that's not what we do. We make all sorts of, you know, parts, mainly engine parts. And the more I dug, the more digging I did on the company, I found out, you know, lots of interesting things. For example, that while they sell to just about every manufacturer, most of their sales are to Ford Motor Company, which, of course, is the only American, you know, auto manufacturer that didn't enter bankruptcy. You know, both GM and Chrysler did, but Ford did not. Another interesting thing is that while they sell parts to just about every type of vehicle, the bulk of their sales are for trucks and SUVs, which when you look at auto sales, that is a very strong component. You know, as the years progress, more people buy trucks, more people buy SUVs than just, you know, standard passenger vehicles. Another interesting thing is I started looking at some of their numbers from the 90s and the early 2000s in the Walker's Manual. And if you were to look at just their financial results, and you did not know that they were an auto parts supplier, you would never guess that they were in the auto industry, because they consistently produced very good returns on equity. They paid very good dividends, and they usually managed to do that with either no debt or very little debt. So I'm like, well, wait a minute. You know, this isn't, you know, your typical auto parts supplier. You know, so it's kind of an interesting little company. But anyway, when I started buying into them, their PE was over one, but less than two. And then, you know, they started coming out with really good earnings. And most of my position I took at, a PE, I guess now, of less than one. Some of their numbers, you know, backed off a little bit. And they still do have, you know, one of their problems is that they have a somewhat underfunded pension. And, you know, there are all sorts of little facets and whatnot to the analysis of the company. But, you know, I've met with management. I've attended the annual meeting, which was interesting because...
I was going to ask, how many individual shareholders are attending an annual meeting of a small company like that?
One outsider. You know, there'll be the company management and the board of directors, of course. And they're like, who are you? You know, because I'm just some guy walking in off the street, you know, to a very nice, you know, hotel banquet room that they're having the meeting in. They're like, oh, you know, you want to be down the hall, you know, thinking that I'm, you know, there for something else. I'm like, no, I'm here for Federal Screw. They're like, wow, you know, you're the first outsider in like 15 years or something. So, you know, at first they were a little, you know, surprised, but, you know, once you tell them, you know, who you are and, you know, I followed your company and, you know, it's my largest position and, you know, so on and so forth.
What percentage of your portfolio is it, if you don't mind me asking?
Let's see here. It is probably about between 25 and 30%.
Okay.
Yep, at this point. And it's had a nice little run. So I'm quite happy about that. But, you know, it was really cool because at the annual meeting after, you know, all the formalities and record keeping are taken care of, I've got the ear of the CEO, the board of directors, and senior management. You know, so I was able to ask them, you know, I've got a list of like 40 questions and, you know, talk to them for over an hour and a half.
Yeah.
It was very nice. And I was impressed that they answered most of my questions and, you know, filled me in on, you know, all sorts of company history and interesting things and, stuff that would, I don't want to say be impossible to find out, but would be very difficult to do unless you actually went to the annual meeting and talked to these guys. And this is not the first time I've done that. You know, whenever I can, I try to attend annual meetings, and I will very frequently call up, you know, the CEO, CFO, or senior managers, and, you know, ask them questions. And I found out that that doesn't always work out, you know, because sometimes, you know, you'll get a bad feeling or what they're saying and what they're doing kind of don't align or don't jibe, or, you know, you can get a good feel, you can get a bad feel. You know, and it's not, you know, not 100% obviously, but I think it is worth doing. And then the other thing is I think if more investors would actively engage with management, say, hey, we're watching the stock, we watch the company, we're watching what you're doing, I think the returns of the companies would probably be a little bit better, you know, because a lot of times management just kind of, you know, they have their own little fiefdoms, and they, I don't want to say they run wild, but some of them do. And they run the companies for their benefit, excuse me, and not the benefit of the shareholders. So I think it is a good thing for shareholders, you know, to vote their shares, to engage with management, to go to the annual meetings if you can. You know, and I think that that would be a good trend, you know, if people can do it. And I think, you know, they'll get a better feel, a better understanding of their investments. So that's something that I started doing, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. And it's generally worked out pretty well for me. So,
yeah.
Very, very interesting. I want to go back to something you said earlier when you said you invest in gray market ADRs and you explain to people what ADRs are. What did you mean by gray market for the listeners out there?
Well, the gray market, those are not...
That's not a common term for most people.
Yeah. We know what that means, but...
Well, the gray market will be like, I guess there's two different types of ADRs. You know, there's sponsored and then there's unsponsored, which means that, a bank will be sponsoring the ADRs and they buy them, and that they're traded frequently. For example, Caledonia Mining, that does trade every day. And it does have, for small investors, you know, Goldman Sachs is not going to be interested in this, but you know, if you want to invest $1,000 or $2,000 or $10,000, you can take a position in it, you can get into it, and you can get out of it. But there are other stocks that I've owned. Emperor Entertainment out of Macau is one of them. It may trade once every 3 months, so you've got to be very careful with the liquidity in some of these things. But in their home market, they will trade every day, and there is adequate liquidity over there. So, and gray market stuff may not be updated. They're not filing, they're not always filing. And so it's just another level of, you know, you have to do your own due diligence.
Right. Now, in the Walker's manual that you brought up before, lot of those companies, if I recall, did not file, right?
And if the laws on this are changing, but if you have under 300 registered shareholders, you may delist and not...
And go dark.
Right, go dark and not have to, file with the regulators. Which can be a very, very important thing for small companies and can save them quite a bit of money. You know, I've seen varying figures on how much it costs to do all the filings and such, and that can be anywhere from, say, $500,000 to over $1 million a year.
Especially for, a company with $10 million in revenue or something, that's a big deal.
Oh, huge, huge, huge. And... but going back to the Walker's manual is a
which
lot of...
Which doesn't exist anymore, right, if I recall?
Right? Yeah, the guy, it's not been published for 9 years or 10 years, but...
Why did it stop?
Well, I think the cost of putting out a physical book was just too much for him and his assistant. I actually spoke with the guy that wrote it back in the 90s. His name escapes me right now. But another thing is a lot of the companies in there, like this Federal Screwworks, they've been public for 50 years, 75 years, 100 years even. So they're kind of like, I don't want to say the word dinosaurs, but kind of leftovers, you know, from way, 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 you know, from the 20s or 30s or, you know, even older than that. So some of these companies have been public for 50 plus years, but nowadays they're just so small, you know, and the family and the management may own 20%, 50% of the company. So it's just not followed. It's just not traded. You know, they're frequently kind of smaller, obscure companies. But once again, that's the type of thing I like, because that is an inefficient market.
Now, what is your process, right? Because you don't have a Walker's manual to look through anymore. So what replaced
well,
that for
I,
you?
Well, no, I do have. I eventually went on eBay and bought you because when Walker's manual was being published, I think it was $149 or $200 or it was not a cheap book. But excuse me, I managed to find the issues that I did not have on eBay. And I bought them for, you know, I don't know, $10, $15, something like that. So I've got every, and he also had a Walker's Manual of Community Bank Stocks. And that is also a tremendous resource. And I got, so over time, I got every one that there is.
Is it still relevant? I mean, do you feel
yes.
It's still, yeah.
Yeah, and obviously not every company in there still exists. Some of them went out of business, and some of them got bought out. But right. You would be surprised by how many of those companies still trade. And even though, you know, yeah, the figures are well out of date, you know, you can look at, like, you know, going back to Federal Screw Works, he's got, you know, I don't know, 9 or 10 years of financial data from like 1988 to 2002 or something. So, I mean, you can't rely on that wholly, of course, right. But it does give you an insight into the company.
Gives you good context.
Yeah, good context. And it's a good place to start off, you know, and you can say, oh, these guys used to make money. Maybe they might make money in the future. Or conversely, well, wait a minute. No, they always kind of lost money or just barely broke even. So how is that going to change in the future? So it's just a good starting off point, and it gives you some historical reference. And
is this still your starting point? I mean, when you're doing research, do you start with Walker's, or what are you doing?
Well, yeah, I like to look at Walker's, but what I've got, you know, maybe 24 different ways that I generate ideas or find things. Walker's manual is obviously quite important, but Barron's, you know, I read that every weekend. My dad does also. In fact, that's his favorite thing. But also, you know, the internet is a tremendous place. The Value Investors Club, you get a lot of great ideas from there, or at least I do. The corner of Berkshire and Fairfax is also another tremendously well-run resource. And the quality of the people there is generally very high. You know, it's just a great place to get ideas, to share stories, to test your investment theses on different stocks. And then also, there are other smaller blogs, you know, like Ragnar is a Pirate is, well, that's not really active these days, but that used to be a great resource. OTC Adventures, that's a great blog. Oddball Stocks with Nate Tobik, that's, he does a tremendous job. So if you get out there and look, you can find a lot of these blogs that are, you know, have kind of a value investor's mindset or bent to them. And that's a tremendous resource. Excuse me. Annual reports. I love reading those. And a lot of times, and this is especially true with mining companies, they will frequently benchmark themselves against their competitors. You know, like, how does our dividend compare in relation to, you know, our competitors? What is our cost per ounce of gold mined? You know, and the various different financial metrics.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously the guys that are running Caledonia Mining, know quite a bit more about their industry and competitors than I do, but that's a great place to get, you know, potential ideas by looking at their competitors. So the annual reports, that's something that I like to use. Another thing is who or what I do business with. For instance, in one of my businesses, and I'm kicking myself for this, but I should have seen it coming a mile away, I use tremendous, tremendous amounts of computer memory. And, I'll buy terabytes and terabytes of RAM. You know, just I spend a lot of money on that. And over the past 6 months, depending on the speed and the form factor of the memory, memory prices have more than doubled. You know, so I should have been buying Micron, but unfortunately I didn't.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, and who you do business with, and, you know, just kind of word of mouth in the business community, that's a good way to get ideas. And one of the very, very, very best ways that I get ideas is by trading ideas with other investors and blog operators, you know, guys that actually run blogs. For instance, there's a company called Callaway's Nursery, which is a nurse, you know.
I'm actually familiar. I think this might be the second time that company's actually come up on the podcast, but I'm familiar with the company. Anyway, okay. Go ahead.
Well, if you're familiar with the company, I used to live just outside of Houston, and I spent a lot of time down in Texas. And I am originally from Detroit, and I live in the Detroit area now. But when I was in Houston, it was known that I was in Houston, so somebody reached out to me, and they said, hey, DTE JD 1997, I know you're in Houston, and I want you to do me a favor and take a look at some real estate and this company that is, has got these nurseries, and take a look at it. Go in, check it out. Let me know what you think. So I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll do that for you. Sure. You know, and it wasn't even on my radar scope. I didn't know anything about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got around to it, and Callaway's Nursery at that point, I think, was trading for, 60 or 70 cents a share. And I went and looked at their properties. I'm like, uh-oh, this is crazy. Because one of their properties in Houston probably was worth the market cap of the company at that point in time. And they actually had two properties in Houston, both of them very valuable, one of which they did sell, and they made a just tremendous profit off of it. So I'm like, wait a minute. One property in Houston is almost worth the entire market cap of the company. And they own a second very valuable property, and they own properties up in Dallas. You know, and they've got a running business. So I'm like, wow. I'm going to buy some shares of this company. And I did. And my father did also. And he's done pretty well with his investment. And I did pretty good too. But as soon as it hit $2 a share, I sold. So, you know, I may come to regret my decision on that. But yeah, so somebody reached out to me and asked me to check out, you know, Callaway's Nursery, and I found out that, my goodness, their real estate was just so valuable, you know, and nobody or very few people knew about it. So that was, I made a lot of money off of it. My dad made even more money off of it. And, you know, so the trading of these ideas back and forth amongst different investors, you can just learn or at least I do.
So I'm curious that you bring up a company with valuable property. As someone who, as you said, has read the Walker's Manual, There was a company about 10 years ago that I think only files if you're a shareholder, JG Boswell. Are you familiar with that company?
Yes. Don't they have, cotton or water?
Yeah, water rights. Anyway, I didn't really understand how to value water rights and anything. I was just wondering if you had any insight into that company at all. And if you don't, that's cool. We'll go to another topic.
Well, I have very little insight into it, but from my understanding is that they have water rights primarily in California, in addition to, you know, owning a lot of acreage out there. And for example, I forget the exact specifics, but like a lot of almonds are grown in California. And if you want to grow almonds, you've got to have access to water, because like every pound of almonds needs like 15 gallons of water or something like that. So anyway, so this JG Boswell company has however many water rights that they've got, and then they can lease that out or sell them to farmers. And I guess that can be quite valuable, but to be honest with you, I don't know all the specifics of it. But it certainly could be a very interesting situation.
Now, do you invest other than, say, undervalued stocks? Do you invest in bonds at all, real estate, anything like that?
Well, I will invest anywhere that I think I can make money and I think I've got a good return.
Yeah.
Right now with bonds, you know, with interest rates being at record lows, I think the only opportunity you probably would find with those is maybe in distressed bonds or in bankruptcy or bankruptcy proceedings. But I haven't done anything with bonds for quite a long time. But I do occasionally buy and own real estate, and I've owned office buildings and warehouses in the past, and I just bought some real estate here in December of last year, just outside of Detroit, in a close by suburb. Yeah, it's
now again, when people hear Detroit, they're gonna go, "Oh my God, that's really scary. That's a terrible." Terrible place to be. What had you be attracted to Detroit? Was it that you live close to it, or did you see opportunity?
Well, all of the above. I live.
And for full disclosure, last year I actually went to Detroit to look at real estate. But go ahead.
Okay. Well, Detroit is kind of a weird, unusual place, and yes, it can be very scary, and it certainly can be dangerous. But there is opportunity in and around it, and almost all of my adult life, I've owned and run businesses. And when I moved back to Detroit, I still had a small business that I was running out of a spare bedroom. And it had been in the past quite a bit bigger, and I'm trying to rebuild it. But I started to have a little bit more success with it. I've got all this stuff all around my condo. I'm like, oh, this is crazy. I need more space. So I started looking to rent space and commercial space, and there in the area that I live in, there's a good amount of vacancies, you know, storefronts and smaller office buildings and such. So, you know, I also exercise quite a bit. And one day I was out, you know, just going for a walk, and I saw a for sale sign in an accounting building. So I'm like, well, I'll give them a call, even though I kind of want to rent. So I called them up, and the guy's like, oh, yeah, the building's for sale, but we got a special deal. We're not selling one building. We're selling two buildings because we own the building next door to it, and if you're going to buy them, you're going to buy both. I'm like, what? He's like, yeah, you know, my father passed away. It was his business. And we just want to sell them both, and that's it. We're not interested in renting. We want to sell it. We want to get rid of it. Like, okay, well, how much do you want? It's like 40 grand for both buildings. Like, wow, you know, that That sounds pretty reasonable. So I went to take a look at them. And, you know, both of the buildings were structurally sound. But unfortunately, they hadn't been updated since, like, you know, I don't know, 1975. You know, and they've got, you know, kind of outdated wood paneling and, you know, the carpeting was raggedy. And I'm like, oh, you know, thanks for showing it to me, but I'll get back to you, you know. And he's like, wait a minute, we changed the deal. And I'm like, what do you mean you changed it? He goes, yeah, we changed the price. And I'm thinking, you know, he's going to tell me the price is higher. And he's like, no, instead of 40 grand, it's 25 grand for both buildings. I'm like, okay, you know, I didn't like the interior of them, but, you know, with a $15,000 reduction in price, you know, I can work with that. So let me think about it. And, you know, I had a contractor buddy, you know, and I got him in there and he looked at it and he's like, well, you know, the one, you know, because it's two buildings. He goes, the AC units on both buildings are probably 5 to 7 years old, so they're good to go. The one furnace in the one building is relatively new, but the other one is probably 20 years old, you know, so that, but it works just fine. So that's going to need to be replaced. And, you know, so he did a whole punch list of stuff that needs to be done. But the end result was the buildings were just old in the tooth. You know, they needed, you know, mainly cosmetic changes.
Yeah.
So I bought them, you know, and I paid about, you know, give or take, $11 a square foot for commercial buildings. And this is not in Detroit. This is in a suburb of Detroit. So, like, back in Houston, you couldn't even rent buildings for what I paid to own these buildings. So that really kind of opened my eyes. And one of the things that I did is, the property taxes, the tax assessor's office was saying the buildings were worth $150,000. And I've been fighting them on the tax assessment. And I did have some limited initial success. I got them to lower the tax bill by about 40%. But one of the things I did is I went to the assessor's office. I filed a Freedom of Information request. And I got all the commercial sales for 2 years in the city that I'm in. And I just started going down the list of every single property that, you know, had sold within the past 2 years. And in relation to most of the other sales, oh, I got a bargain. I got a heck of a bargain. However, other people got crazy bargains too, and I mean crazy bargains. So they're in and around Detroit, depending on where you go, you could just find just unbelievable bargains in real estate. So that's an interesting thing, and I can tell you, after my first purchase here, I'm still working on, you know, I've moved my office and operations into the one building, and then I'm going to redo the other building and bring that up to speed. But now that kind of my eyes have been opened to the opportunity that's out there, I'm going to be looking for more opportunities, that's for sure. So, but the thing is once again, you know, kind of like with stocks, you've got to kind of take a contrarian position and you've got to look, you know, under rocks, and you've got to be willing to go, I think, kind of where others do not go. You know, the buildings that I bought, they weren't listed with a realtor. They were just, you know, a little, you know, 1 foot by 1 foot for sale by owner, call this number. And that's the only advertising that they did, you know, in trying to sell these buildings. So yeah, that's some of the realist. But in the past, like, I've bought buildings that need to be rehabbed from, you know, the city or county government. But that may be a story for another time.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, there is, and I think one of the key things, or the thing that's making this real estate deal work for me, is I can almost immediately use half of the space in the building for my own office and my own operations. So if you've got a business or some use that you can put that property to either right away or say within 6 months, that's where I think the best opportunity or the best potential or the best money making way, you know, if you've got a business that you can put in there, you know, I think you'll do well. So I know I'm going to be looking for other properties. That's for sure. You got to be careful because Detroit's a wild and woolly, crazy place.
Yes. Now, we had talked about earlier that you've also made some mistakes as well in your investing career. Talk about one or two, you know, investing mistakes. What was the thesis going into it? What you learned from it?
Well, sometimes I'm kind of thick-headed and slow-witted, so it takes me a while to learn these things, but I try and learn from my mistakes. But one of the biggest mistakes that I've made many, believe me, is back in 1992, maybe 1993, I bought stock in a company called National Beverage. And I used to like to drink their product, which is called Faygo.
I've never heard of it.
No, okay. Well, it's kind of off-brand soda.
Okay.
Here in the Detroit area in the Midwest, you know, Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, you know, and they've got different flavors. Excuse me. They have, like, obviously a cola flavor and a ginger ale, and, you know, but they'll have, like, strawberry and fruit punch and whatnot. And anyway, back then I was in school, so every penny counted. You know, so I'd go and buy this stuff, and I'd even go down into Ohio, which was cheaper than Michigan. Excuse me. And so I saw, wow, National Beverage, I can buy stock in that. And I paid like $4.38, because back then, you know, stocks were quoted in eighths and not decimals. But anyway. So, you know, they were making money, and, you know, there's an interesting little company, and, you know, the stock price went up, you know, just over 100%. So I'm like, yay, I made my money. Now it's time to sell. And, you know, I think I am really, 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 really good at finding bargains and buying stuff, but I am really, really, really bad at selling stuff, because in the time, you know, after I sold this National Beverage, the stock split a few times. I started off with 400 shares, but just to make a very long story short, had I kept this National Beverage today, I would have 7,680 shares. And Thursday it traded, I think, at $85.60 a share. So there would have been quite a little bit of capital appreciation there. But the other interesting thing is that $1,600 that I invested would have returned $76,174 in dividends. So had I held on to that National Beverage till today, that would have been a 490x return.
Holy shit.
Yeah, which works out to about 31% compounded for 22 years.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's, you know, one of these little obscure companies. Well, I guess nowadays they aren't quite so obscure, but you know, my father, he has more than a handful of stocks that have returned 10x, 50x, even well over 100x. You know, and you don't need a whole lot of 100x returns in your investing career, you know, and you're going to do pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, what about an idea where you lost a lot of money?
Well, there've been several of those. You know, going back to the frontier investing, I once invested in a copper miner called Moss and West, and they were a copper company that had their operations in the Democratic Republic of Congo, mm-hmm. which is pretty crazy place from what I hear. But
you've never been? Not looking for real estate out there?
Yeah, no, not yet, but maybe in the future here. But that was, I took a 98% loss on that. And what happened there was, you know, the copper market kind of went south. And the other thing is that they were doing hard rock mining of copper. You know, so they'd go underground and, you know, dig the tunnels to get the copper, which, you know, hard rock mining versus open pit mining. You know, if you're going to be doing hard rock mining, really the only thing that you can do with that is either gold or platinum or diamonds. Everything else, all the base metals, you just want to have, you know, a giant open pit. So that was kind of, you know, and it looked like it was going to work out there for a while because they were making good money, but they just, you know, the market turned, so they started making a lot less. And then, you know, when you're doing hard rock mining, you've got such huge capital commitments that they just couldn't make it. And so I took, I think, a 99% loss on that. Here's another thing that another stock that I made a huge mistake on, kind of, sort of. I actually have not really lost too much money with it, but I could have made a ton of money on it, you know, had I played my cards a little bit differently. A company called Awilco Drilling, and what they are is they are a Norwegian oil service company that owns a couple of drilling rigs that, you know, go in the North Sea, and they, you know, they extract oil from offshore deposits. And this Awilco Drilling, this was a very interesting stock in that, you know, it's one of these, you know, gray market traded, you know, in the U.S. And it was also one of the companies that Yahoo and Google and all the quote services were not accurately reporting on. And this Awilco Drilling, when I bought it, had, you know, I think it was somewhere in the vicinity of like a 24% dividend. And if you went and looked at the quote services, you know, they were reporting that there's, you know, no dividend on it. And people on Yahoo, you know, on the Yahoo discussion groups, they get into arguments with them. You know, I'm like, you know, look, I've already gotten, you know, $4 a share in dividends. And, you know, the dividends is, you know, whatever it is. And they would argue, well, no, there is no dividends in this company because Yahoo says that there isn't.
And as we know, Yahoo is always right.
Right. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, do I have to return my money now? You know, and some of these people, I don't understand how they could be so dense that they wouldn't go to the company's website, look at it, and see, oh yeah, you know, Yahoo is mistaken, and DTE JD 1997 actually did get, you know, the dividends that he said he got. But, you know, the interesting thing in that is that that is where the opportunities come up. But there are people out there that'll say, no, there are no dividends paid for a Wilco drilling, and you're an idiot, and I'm not investing, and, you know, this is stupid. So, okay, you know what, you know, how do you argue with that? But you know, where people will just, they won't do the research, that leads to opportunities. So this Awilco drilling, I bought about $10 a share, and they started making tons of money and paying tons of dividends, and the stock went to like, something like $24 a share pretty quickly, say within a year and a half. And at that point, you know, I was sitting on a huge gain. And the mistake that I made was that, yes, the research I did was good. And yes, the management of the company was good. And yes, they had it set up and structured better than Seadrill and better than any of their competitors. But the killer mistake that I made was that, yes, I was right in my research, but I was wrong on the industry, and oil prices collapsed. And the mistake, you know, that I made was I selected the best company in a terrible time in a terrible industry.
And you know, I did that once with retail, like okay. This year.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's, what is that, the anchoring basis or anchoring fallacy is that, yes, I was right that they are better there than their competitors, but I took my eye off of the industry as a whole. And the stock now has gone down quite significantly, and even though I've gotten back just about everything that I paid for it in dividends, had I been paying better attention and had I not making that stupid mistake, I could have had a really nice gain instead of, you know, breaking even or making 10%. And for me, you know, that was a lot of money. And so I guess what I'm saying is you can be right in your research and right in your competitive in the analysis of the company's competitive position, but if the industry, you know, like oil goes down by 2/3, you're screwed, you know.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, of course, it's easier said than done, but, you know, that's one of the huge mistakes that I've made. Another mistake is kind of being impatient. You know, I think that I'm more patient than most, but some ideas may take years to play out. You know, and after I've been sitting on something for a year, 2 years, 3 years, and, you know, it hasn't really done anything, it's like my fingers get itchy, you know, and I want to, you know, I want to redeploy it because I've got tremendously more ideas than I've got capital, you know, so the temptation to move out into something else, you know, going back to National Beverage, you know, yay, I doubled my money quickly, which is a very good accomplishment, you know, and I did well, but, you know, but then I was stupid because I just should have let it grow and have been patient with it. You know, and that's not the only company. I don't know if you're familiar with a company called Seaboard.
I am familiar with a company called Seaboard.
Yeah, I bought a bunch of shares in that at like between $140 and $150 a share.
So that must have been over 10 years ago.
Yes, this was back in the mid-90s.
And how did you hear about them?
I heard about them actually from Barron's, and it was, you know, kind of a you know, small cap company that was being small cap obscure company that was being profiled, and I'm like, wow. That's just the type of thing I like to buy. You know, and the stock went up, and so, of course, I promptly sold. But my dad still owns his shares. You know, he's got, 85 shares. And let me look here. You know, that he bought just about the same time I bought mine. And, you know, Thursday it closed at $39.87. So, you know, that's another one of my many stupid mistakes.
Well, I bought Seaboard at around 800.
Okay.
And I sold it a little over 1,000, so.
Okay,
so that was about a decade ago.
Okay, I've got good company then. I'm not the only one that makes stupid mistakes. So yeah, that's
I bought Seaboard below book value.
Okay. but yeah, no, and I think, you know, it's an interesting company. Their shipping operations, you know, right now the shipping industry is just being decimated, but these guys can actually use the ships, you know, to move their grain and jalapeno peppers that they make down in Honduras. And, you know, so going back to the real estate that I bought, you know, I've got a use for part of it. And the Seaboard, you know, just like, you know, if they can buy distressed assets and put them to work instead of trying to, you know, just rent them out or charter the ships, you know, Seaboard still might have, you know, the managers that run it. I think they are well above average and they do a good job. So, you know, who knows? We could be
pretty decent.
Yeah, you know, but in 20 years we could be, you know, miserating. Oh, we're so stupid. We should have bought Seaboard at $3,500. Now it's $35,000. So you know, one of my mistakes is I you know, frequently I'm not properly capitalized, you know, and I get anxious. You know, another good example of this is Meritage Hospitality, which I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's a Michigan restaurant company. They own Wendy's, and they also own, excuse me, their own proprietary chain called, Twisted Rooster or something like that. But anyway, I read about it on one of the value blogs, you know, and I bought many thousand shares at, you know, $1.45. And the stock really didn't do anything for a while, but then all of a sudden it went up to, you know, $3.50, $4 a share. So, of course, you know, I'm like, yay, I made money. I'm going to get the, I'm going to get the money. And, of course, I promptly sold, you know, at $4, $5 a share, which is a good return. But of course, you know, Thursday, the stock, and this was much more recent. I was buying those shares in 2008, 2009, I believe. You know, and Thursday closed at $13.70 a share. You know, and the company still may have quite a bit of growth ahead of it. So, you know, and then also another thing is I bought a bunch of banking companies back in 08, 09, and was buying them for way, way, way under tangible book.
Book value, yeah.
You know, and I did really good on them. You know, I made really good money. And in fact, you know, Ragnar is a pirate. Well, his real name is Jeff Moore. Of course, that's no secret. But, you know, he's a very gracious guy, and he let me write, you know, several guest contributor articles on this Rurban Financial, which I think you can still see over at his website. You know, so that'll, you know, if anybody's interested in reading them, that'll give them, you know, insight into how I think about things, kind of, sort of. And, you know, once again, you know, the stock goes up, you know, 3 or 4X, you know, and I got itchy fingers and I sell it. And then it doubles and triples from there, you know, and they pay dividends. And so that's, you know, that's one of the things I'm trying to change as I move forward, is to have a lot more patience, you know, and try not to, you know, okay, I got an idea, just let it grow, be patient. you know, my dad, he's an expert at that. You know, he can hold a stock for 20 years. You know, he won't bat an eye. So that's, I give him props for that because, you know, he's got much more patience than I do. That's for sure.
Well, it's very, very interesting what you do. Is there anything else while you're on the show that, you know, you want to share about or talk about before we get going? We've covered a lot.
Yeah, we have. And the time's gone by pretty quickly. But yeah, just going back to the frontier investing, you know, there are all sorts of crazy situations out there that if you are willing to dig, you know, a lot of American investors will say, oh, I don't want to buy Chinese companies. I don't want to buy African companies. But if you really do the digging, you'll see, wait a minute, they've got, you know, typically better balance sheets than American companies. They pay bigger dividends, you know, and their valuation levels are so much lower. And, you know, a lot of them can have real estate optionality. You know, there were a couple of Chinese contract manufacturers that I either own or did own, Namtai and Deswell Industries.
I own Namtai. I used to own Namtai, too. Oh, okay.
My dad has owned Namtai, I think, since like 1989. But one of the best days I ever had in the market was back when they were doing the screens for the Apple iPhones. And word got out, and I think I had like 7,000 shares, you know, and the earnings came out, and, you know, everybody was whispering, oh, they're working for Apple. You know, and the stock went up like, I think it was 3 points overnight. I'm like, yay, all right. That's one of the best days. But, you know, and that's another stupid mistake. You know, I should have either sold some of it or, you know, sold covered calls or done something with it. But, you know, the stock went way up and then they got out of it and it's come back down. But it still may be an investable stock because, of course, as you know, they've got all that property in Shenzhen.
Yes.
And
I didn't remember where it was, but I remember they had a lot of property in it. Yep, just Shenzhen.
Yeah, just across the bay from Hong Kong. But the interesting thing is Mr. Ku, who's the CEO of Namtai.
You remember way more about the situation than I do. I do not remember the management's name.
Well, I had a lot of my investable net worth in it at the time, but... But he had a track record of buying properties, especially in Hong Kong, you know, that were, you know, I don't know, farm fields back in 1976 when they got started. You know, 15, 20 years later, now it's all built up industrial properties, you know, and it's worth 100 times what they paid for it. And he did this multiple times throughout the history of the company, and it looks like he's going to do it one last time, you know, with the property in Shenzhen. But Namtai, you know, a lot of people, you know, years ago didn't know about this property. But if you had done the due diligence and the research, you could have found out about it. And, it's a similar thing potentially with this Deswell. I don't know if you're familiar with that stock, but...
I'm familiar with it.
Yeah, some of their managers actually used to work for Namtai. So, you know, perhaps they learned, you know, at the knee of Mr. Ku as to how to do the, you know, property development. But you know, Deswell pays a good dividend. They've got a rock-solid balance sheet. But a lot of people don't know is that they own property. It could be potentially worth many times what the company is traded for. So the interesting thing is if you're willing to dig a little bit, I think overseas is a much more fertile hunting ground than the U.S. So for all those other investors out there, I would say, you know, don't be afraid to go and to look at interesting, unusual countries, interesting, unusual situations. There's definitely opportunity out there. You know, and if you want to have market-beating returns, you've got to be willing to do things that most other people can't or won't do. So.
Now, you know, I'm usually good at wrapping up a show, but I'm going to break my rule here and ask you one more question because it just came up for me. You know, you said that a starting point for a lot of the obscure stuff you do, one of the starting points at least, is the Walker's manuals. But when you're buying, you know, say looking in Africa and looking at some of these, you know, countries with some more instability, where's your starting point for that? Because when you say, you know, go look in Africa, a lot of people are not going to know how to do that.
Well, yeah, that's a good question. Well, here's here we go. Seeking alpha. For instance, with, say, going back to Caledonia Mining, one of the things that I've done, and anybody can do this if they've got, you know, a little bit of time and energy, is you find one company, and you know, one obscure company in Africa or Asia or whatever. So you go over to Seeking Alpha, and a lot of the stuff there is not very good, to be honest, but some of it is. So you type it in and you look at the articles that come up. You know, now you'll see a couple few articles on Caledonia Mining. So you're like, okay, and you go and read those articles. And now here's where you find out about other things, is you look at the author of that article, and you can look at the other articles that they've written. So if somebody has the knowledge and time to write an article on Caledonia Mining, they might know about, you know, Mandalay Resources. You're like, woo, that's an interesting company. So you look at, you know, okay, who's writing articles on Caledonia? And you look at the other articles that they've written, and you'll pick up other names there.
Not
that these will necessarily be investable ideas, but you learn about who the competitors are. Or you look at the annual report, and in the annual report they'll say, you know, okay, here we are, and here's our competitors. You know, the Joe Blow Copper Company and Two Dudes in a Shed Copper Company and Three Stooges Copper Company. And, you know, so you just start going down the list. And one company will lead you to three or four or five other ideas. And it's like a net almost. You know, and it just branches out from there, and you'll just start seeing other ideas. But, you know, look at who is doing the research on this, and then look at the other research that they're doing. And that'll lead you, you know, and you just go on down the chain. And it does require a lot of time and energy, but you will find other investable ideas doing this, because I know I have. So, I hope that kind of answers.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it was a pleasure having you on the show today. Thank you again for coming on.
Well, thank you, Eric. I certainly appreciate you taking the time, and I'm honored to have a forum here to share my ideas with a broader audience. And I hope that the people listening might get some ideas. And if they get ideas, you know, share them with the other value investors, because that's that makes a community, and you know, sharing ideas is a great thing. So, Eric, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
Okay, you too, Eric. Take care.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast with Eric Schlein. If you'd like to connect with Eric for questions, comments, feedback, ideas, or to inquire about being on the show, please contact Eric at intelligentinvesting@gmail.com. So, in the words of Charlie Munger, I have nothing to add.